for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. As the Obama administration considers ways to fund the health care overhaul, obesity experts came up with an idea. Put a federal tax on sugared beverages and use the funds to offset health care costs. The beverage industry is waging a fierce PR battle against the idea. Joining me in the studio to talk about soft drinks, obesity, and whether a tax would make a difference, Justin Wilson. He's with the Center for Consumer Freedom. Joining us from a studio at WNPR in Hartford, Connecticut, Kelly Brownell of Yale University's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity. We'll take your calls throughout the hour, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Before we begin our conversation with our guests, we're joined by phone from San Francisco by Dr. David Kessler. He is the former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane.
Good to hear your voice. Tell us the connection between the obesity epidemic and drinking sugary beverages.
Let me give you the science. I mean, I was in Birmingham, Alabama last week. And I was at the university, and they're some of the greatest obesity researchers in the country, and certainly Alabama, you know, is one of the states that lead the nation in this epidemic. The average school-age child, consumes 1,000 calories a day of either soda, sweet tea, or Sunny D. Sunny D is just an orange drink. It's not, you know, real juice. It's an orange drink. 1,000 calories a day coming from soda, sweet tea, Sunny D. What's the one ingredient in all three? Sugar.
You know what's so fascinating? When I was a young kid, I mean, a Coke or a Pepsi, a soft drink of any kind was a special treat. What you're saying is that these kids are now getting it on a regular basis.
That's the real concern. Now, we have the link, right? We do have the link between consumption and the risk of obesity. You know, a recent UCLA study showed that if you drink one or more sodas a day, one more sodas or other sugar-sweetened beverages every day, you are at a greater risk, about 27% more likely to be overweight or obese than if you didn't.
But is there any dispute among the scientists and the doctors about that?
No. I mean, that study has been confirmed. David Ludwig, a number of years ago, one of the great pediatric endocrinologists, obesity experts, in a study of Massachusetts school-age children, showed that for each additional sweet drink consumed every day, the odds of obesity increased very significantly.
Now, what about the connection between consumption and diabetes? Is that also there?
The link is absolutely there when it comes between obesity and type 2 diabetes. For type 2 diabetes, Diane, I could just as well write obesity in the medical chart. Hmm. The problem is that sugar, certainly highly concentrated sugar beverages, they promote overeating. The liquid calories, one of the greatest problems with drinking, I mean, in liquid calories, is that there's not the same kind of satiation signals. You just don't get as full. But understand what sugar does. At the core, right, sugar is a reinforcer. It's the most, you know, certainly in food, it's the most potent reinforcer. And what does that mean? It means we keep on coming back for more and more. But the problem is that our behavior, and it's not just our behavior, it's the behavior of our kids, is becoming conditioned and driven. 1,000 extra calories a day these school-age kids are taking in. And that's setting up conditioned behavior. That's setting up that learning, that neural circuitry that lasts for a lifetime.
All right.
And that has profound implications for policy.
So as during your time as FDA commissioner, you talked about the addictive quality of nicotine. Are you now talking about the sugary drinks, as you use the phrase reinforcing? Does that translate to addictive?
It certainly involves the same neural circuitry. Hmm. It involves the same learning, memory, habit, and motivational circuitry of the brain. There is no question. And the behavior becomes repetitive and self-sustaining. That's my concern.
Dr. David Kessler, former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Diane.
And now, turning to Kelly Brownell, he's director of Yale University's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity. Kelly Brownell, do you agree with Dr. Kessler, not only about the consumption, but the effects on diabetes and obesity?
I do. I believe David Kessler very nicely summarized the science. If you look at the research on sugared beverage intake and risk for diseases like obesity and diabetes, the studies are rock solid. About the only studies that don't disagree are ones that the industry itself has funded. The issue of addiction gets pretty tricky, and I'm not quite sure the science is there yet to say that these beverages are addictive, but it's building almost by the day.
So you have now called for a tax.
Correct.
Explain.
Well, for something as controversial as a tax, you want to be on solid scientific ground, and I believe a compelling case can be made for taxing sugared beverages, much like we've done with tobacco now for many years. The link between these beverage intakes and health outcomes is completely solid, as I said. The revenue that could be raised for something like this could be considerable, and if the money, $150 billion, for example, over 10 years for a penny an ounce tax, if it were done federally, that's a lot of money that could be used to go back to the people who are most vulnerable for these problems.
Kelly,
so if they were used for...
Kelly Brownell, he's director of Yale University's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity. Turning to you now, finally, Justin Wilson. He's senior research analyst at the Center for Consumer Freedom. I gather that is a libertarian lobbying group. Who finances that group?
We're composed of a coalition of a whole slew of individuals and companies, and yes, the food industry. We're not hiding anything, but we come at this from an ideological perspective, so we'll take funding from anyone who agrees with us.
So what do you think of a proposed tax?
Well, I think that a soda tax is effectively just the latest and greatest fad diet. I mean, so many people have, I'm going to eliminate chocolate from my diet, or I'm not going to eat this or not going to eat that, and it always ends up failing. And that's why a lot of the researchers have said that soda alone is no way near the silver bullet when it comes to this. But the policy is wrong for three separate reasons. First of all, it's just bad policymaking because there's no proof that this will have any impact on a decrease in consumption of soda. In fact, the latest study that came out of Emory University and that was reanalyzed by the Mackinac Center for Public Policy suggested you'd have to tax soda at 1,200% before you would see real serious declines in obesity. You have to effectively make soda so that's something not part of our diet anymore. And that, of course, assumes that people wouldn't replace it with fruit juice or beer or wine, something else that has calories, which, frankly, I think is a very realistic thing. But from an ideological perspective, I don't think that the tax code should be a tool of social engineering. This is just a gimmick, right? I live in Washington, D.C. They were going to attempt to put a tax – or excuse me, charge us a fee to keep our streetlights on because they wanted, of course, to free up more money for their general budget. And this is the same kind of situation where Congress has shaken all of their couch cushions for money and they're looking for more money. And they know that they can only pass this if they can give the excuse, well, we're doing this for obesity and we're trying to decrease obesity. And yet even when you ask people, we conducted a poll just last month. We said, would you support a tax on soda for the purpose of reducing consumption? And more than two-thirds of the country says no. And that's because it fundamentally is the public health community, Dr. Brownell, I think ignores the fact that people actually enjoy soda and that there is some value in that. And that this notion of, well, we should just eliminate it from our diet and that will solve obesity is just so simplistic. And especially when you ignore the fact that in the end, it's our diet. And I don't understand why the government or Dr. Brownell or anyone else should be telling me what I can and cannot eat.
So you think that a tax on soda in particular, even considering Dr. Kessler's statement that children are consuming 1,000 calories a day from soda.
Well, to tell you the truth, I'm not quite sure where that came from. I do know that according to the National Cancer Institute, which analyzed the NHANES data set, which is the biggest federal data set, that soda contributes to about 5%, or sugar-sweetened beverages are about 5% of our diet. So think of that. If we were to completely eliminate those, then we wouldn't be able to end obesity.
Justin Wilson, senior research analyst for the Center for Consumer Freedom. Short break, right back. And as I'm sure you know by now, there are proposals out there to tax soft drinks at something like a penny an ounce. You've heard all kinds of statements about how they do contribute to obesity, how the government would use that tax to try to offset some of the cost of the health care plan. We have two people with us today. Justin Wilson is senior research analyst at the Center for Consumer Freedom. Kelly Brownell is director of Yale University's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity. We're going to open the phones in just a moment. Join us on 800-433-8850. Here's an email from Tom who says, great show. Have you considered taxing obesity? We could tax obese people $10 per pound per person and pay for all of our health care. I drink plenty of soda, but I run marathons and burn off my calories. Why should I be taxed? Soda does not make people fat. Lack of exercise makes one fat. Kelly Brownell.
There have been recent studies that have looked at the relative contribution of diet and physical inactivity to obesity. In fact, both are important. But the recent studies suggest that physical inactivity is far less important as a contributor than diet overall. And much like with tobacco, you don't want to penalize the people necessarily for the condition they develop from the product. You wouldn't want to tax people for having lung cancer, for example, but you'd want to tax the product to discourage its consumption. And tobacco taxes, by the way, were the greatest contributor to the decline in cigarette smoking that's happened over the past 40 and 50 years, and that was listed as one of the greatest public health victories of the last century.
Now, here's a fascinating piece which is going to lead us into a sense of what's out there in terms of people's reaction to this idea.
Families around here are counting pennies to get through this economy. So when we hear about another tax, it gets our attention. Washington is talking about a new tax on juice drinks and soda. They say it's only pennies. Well, those pennies add up when you're trying to feed a family. Washington, if you're listening, what doesn't seem like much to you can be a lot to us.
Tell Congress, no taxes on juice, drinks, and sodas.
And here's an email from Karen in Charlotte. To follow up on that ad, she says, for the poor among us, Coke is far cheaper than milk with dinner. It's so sad to see young children walking around with bottles full of fizzy, sugary soda drinks, and once they're hooked, I think that's pretty much it for life. What are we going to do about that? Kelly Brownell.
Well, that's a very good point. The problem for many foods in our environment, not just soda, is that the unhealthy foods are the cheapest and the healthy foods cost more. And one of the benefits of a tax is it would help reverse that, especially if the money were used, say, to subsidize things like fruits and vegetables to drive down their cost. And in that way, the poor would be the most helped. By the way, that ad that you just ran was done by the soda industry, as one might guess. And there's no better evidence to me that a soda tax would work or sugar beverage tax would work than how hard the industry is fighting against it. Because if it weren't going to drive down consumption, as Justin said, why in the world would they spend so much money fighting it?
Justin, do you want to respond?
Oh, certainly. Well, you know, the important thing that I think we need to keep track of is that, you know, the soda industry, or actually it's a much larger group than just the soda industry that ran that ad, you know,
Who did run that ad?
I think it's a coalition of like 71,000 small companies. I can't remember what their website says. It's called.
As well as the big.
I'm sure there's some major corporations.
Sure.
I tell you the truth, I don't remember exactly who's involved.
Okay.
But because it's not our group. But when it comes to that, we're opening the door to an entirely new taxing structure. One that does not seek to raise revenue for things that are costing revenue, but taxes as need to be more perfect than what a soda tax is. That is to say, you know, the person who sent the email and says, well, we should be taxing obesity is actually getting at something. You know, soda is only 5% of our diet. And of course, it's only the overconsumption of soda that leads to obesity. And obesity is only one factor that causes the health problems that ultimately are costing us healthcare money.
Kelly, how do you respond?
I agree, with part of it at least. There are many things contributing to obesity, and there's nobody that I know of that says that soda or sugared beverages is the only contributing factor. And I know of nobody that said that this would help reverse the obesity problem by itself. And so to argue that it wouldn't reverse the obesity epidemic by itself, fine, I agree with that. But you have to start somewhere because we're essentially doing very little to tackle this problem as a nation. And where would you start? The place where the science is the strongest, and the link between sugared beverage intake and health is stronger than it is for any other single category. The economists have suggested that a tax would decrease consumption enough to benefit public health.
Has anybody studied the effects, for example, of cookies or potato chips or cake or anything of that sort, Kelly?
Yes, but just not as much as the sugared beverage intake.
I see.
As I mentioned earlier, a tax is a controversial proposal, to be sure, and you don't want to do anything like this unless you're pretty sure it would have benefit. And so we're not ready to propose taxes on other foods because there just aren't enough studies on them. Now, at some point there may be, but the evidence on soda and sugared beverages is rock solid.
Now, how do you respond to that, Justin? With the evidence being as strong as it is among not only obesity specialists, but scientists themselves.
Well, this has become a bit of a divide-and-conquer strategy for taxing the much larger portion of the food industry. I mean, Dr. Brownell's tax, I think he even joked that it was the Twinkie tax, you know, because snack foods are next, and that's certainly something people are talking about.
I have never said that myself.
Oh, really? I apologize. No. I know that it is sort of bantered about in the press as having its nickname, but it frustrates me that, you know, something that is only a small proportion of the diet is getting taxed to this proportion, especially when you consider that it's only the overconsumption of any form of calorie, right? Soda is no different than a whole slew of other things that contain calories and when eaten in excess for a long period of time will lead to obesity. The other trouble, though, I find with this policy is that when you tax something and it comes out of people's pockets, the entirety of the benefit is, of course, lost in terms of the monetary stream. So when it came to dairy taxes, they said that the average family was paying $40 a year for dairy taxes and that that was causing a revenue stream for the federal government of $40 a year. It's, you know, you save a penny and you lose a penny. So the money is coming out of taxpayers' pockets and going to the government just to pay for health care. And it's a gimmick to pay for health care because I don't think Dr. Brownell thinks we'll actually be able to see a real significant decrease in obesity.
Kelly Brownell, what about that? How can you truly assume that putting a tax on a soft drink is either going to reduce obesity or have that money from taxes go directly into health care?
It's only the idea of a sugar beverage tax has been around for about 15 years, and it's only recently that the idea got coupled with paying for health care. So I think the two issues should be uncoupled. A tax on sugared beverage could have independent beneficial effects on public health no matter what one does with the revenue. That's a home run. But if you then use the revenue for needed programs that could reduce obesity, then you've turned the home run into a grand slam. Now, there is risk the government would not use the money wisely, and that's happened in some cases with money raised from tobacco taxes. So Mr. Wilson raises an important point there, and I think that should be taken seriously. It's very important that if laws get written and the revenue is to be used for something, that it be completely used for health-related problems.
I know that you first proposed a tax back in April and that you co-authored a paper with the then New York City Health Commissioner, Dr. Thomas Frieden, who is now the head of the Centers for Disease Control. Is Dr. Frieden on board with this idea of taxing soft drinks?
Well, I certainly can't speak for him, and you'd have to talk to him yourself, but the fact that he co-authored that paper with me is a good sign that at least at that point he was in favor of the idea of a tax. And his presence in this argument, I think, is very impressive because he was health commissioner of New York City, and they have tremendously high problems with diseases related to poor diet, and he was living it every day. He saw what the health care costs were. He saw how much human suffering there was, and in that paper came out with me in favor of a tax on sugared beverages. So at least at that point, he felt it would be a beneficial public health move.
And what about the Obama administration? Are they taking a look at this tax, or are you aware that they are?
I'm not certain because the idea of a tax in the context of funding health care reform is on the table, off the table, on and off. And at the moment, I believe it's off the table. And whether it will pop back in at the 11th hour as a way of funding health care reform, I don't know. But if tobacco tax is any precedent, the action will happen first in the states and not at the federal level. In fact, there's some evidence that that is occurring. The state of California is going to hold hearings in early November on the issue of sugared beverages, and who knows where that could lead.
Justin.
You know, talking about New York, I think it's worth talking about the last time the government tried to step in and change the way that we eat, because fundamentally, the government has a bad record when it comes to trying to change our diets. So Dr. Frieden, I guess supported by Kelly, passed a bill that would require mandatory menu labeling in New York, saying that it was going to reduce massive amounts of obesity. And Kelly wrote an editorial in the Journal of the American Medical Association this summer saying this was a good policy. We didn't know if it was going to work, but at this point, you know, we need to start adapting policies before we know if they're going to work. And the trouble was, last week, the first study came out, and they found out that even people who saw the calorie counts were eating just as many calories. In fact, they were eating slightly more. The policy in New York seems to have failed. And when we start to plunge head first into these kinds of policies, especially when the economists are saying they're not going to decrease obesity, and when it has an enormous cost on ordinary Americans, I don't think that's the right way to be formulating policies, especially given this atrocious track record.
But, of course, in New York, there was not a tax involved. There was simply labeling involved.
Well, and, you know, I'm frustrated by the public health community's mentality of, well, if that one failed, we need more. We're getting away from this notion of personal responsibility because everyone put on the weight using personal responsibility, and everyone who's lost weight has lost weight through personal responsibility. Even Dr. Brownell said that when he was writing his book, he put on a few pounds because he didn't go walking as often.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Dr. Brownell, what do you make of that?
Well, first, in regard to menu labeling, nobody ever claimed that it would lead to massive reductions in obesity, as Mr. Wilson said the public health community claimed. And also, the first study that came out on this was weak, had a lot of problems, and there are a number of studies in the pipeline that will show quite the opposite, that menu labeling is having a benefit. On to the issue of personal responsibility, to say that the nation's obesity problem is due to personal irresponsibility I think is misleading. We have record levels of obesity in this country, and they have very little in countries like Somalia or Ethiopia. Is it because they're responsible and we're not? When people move to the United States from other countries, they gain weight. When they move from here to other countries, they tend to lose weight. When you put lab animals on a diet that Americans have access to, they gain weight. Are they irresponsible? Are the people flying from one country to another to spend time irresponsible? It's not a very good argument. And if you explain the obesity problem by personal responsibility, you're essentially frozen from doing anything very constructive because your only solution to that is try to educate or implore people to behave differently. We've been doing that now for 30 years, and it's been completely ineffective. The obesity problem has just grown worse during that time. So it's not time for more of the same. It's time to do something different, and that's where public policy gets involved.
And on the issue of public policy, here's an email from Billy in Kernersville, North Carolina, who says, soft drinks are prevalent because they're cheap. They're cheap because they're mostly corn syrup, which is cheap because of farm subsidies for corn. Corn syrup has become too common in all foods we consume. It seems ironic that the government would tax something they have helped to encourage. What do you think, Dr. Brownell?
I absolutely agree. When Mr. Wilson says government should stay out of our decisions about what the government, in fact, is quite involved. They set nutrition policy. They set dietary standards, and the food industry has been heavily involved in that process. And then they do things like subsidize certain parts of the agriculture industry, in particular the corn farmers in this case. And these subsidies were put into effect back in the Nixon administration to help farmers. So there was no malintent in terms of nutrition. But now we've known for a decade or two that they might be having negative impacts on diet because they're driving down the cost of sweetening things. And so lining up government agriculture policy with health policy, which is what the new Secretary of Agriculture, Secretary Vilsack, has said is an imperative, is absolutely important in helping address the diet-related problems in the country.
Justin.
Sure. Well, first of all, I'd like to clear up this bizarre urban myth that high fructose corn syrup is any different than sugar. Nutritionally, they are absolutely positively the same. And if you don't trust me, then you can look at the American Dietetic Association or the American Medical Association who agree with that.
Let's get Dr. Brownell's response on that. Do you agree?
I agree.
Mm-hmm. Agree?
Yep.
Okay.
The most recent evidence suggests that once these sweeteners get into the body, they don't behave too differently.
Okay.
More studies should show that different in the future, but at the moment I agree with that. But the fact that it becomes inexpensive to sweeten things with the subsidies to the high fructose corn syrup make the problem even more severe.
But,
and your listener is right. It makes them cheap.
So what's important, though, is that high fructose corn syrup, the production of it actually doesn't the price of corn doesn't contribute greatly to the total price of high fructose corn syrup, when the opposite is true with sugar. And the problem with sugar, which is the alternative to sweetening these beverages, is that they've created a monopoly in the United States with the sugar policy. But it's important to note that there's no direct subsidies going to farmers that grow corn any longer. We decoupled our policy so that the subsidies that farmers receive are not actually for any specific crop that they're growing. And in fact, in recent years, the market price of corn has risen above what the price floor is that the federal government will pay these farmers because of ethanol production. So it's a little bit of a non-starter to say that, and maybe it was true in the past, but it's not necessarily true now.
Now, what about diet drinks? Dr. Brownell, very quickly, what's your thinking?
Very interesting. There are two levels of concern with diet drinks. Number one is concerns with the safety of the sweeteners, and second is that they may not, in fact, help people control their weight. And there's a tiny bit of evidence suggesting the opposite. But we don't feel that the science on either of those two issues is strong enough to suggest, say, taxing the diet drinks. So
Kelly,
for now, we'd say fine.
Kelly Brownell, director of Yale University's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. By the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
It was called The Miracle on the Hudson. Airline pilot Sally Sullenberger talks about his emergency landing of a passenger jet on the Hudson River. He offers his thoughts on heroism and what really matters. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. It's time to open the phones as we talk about a proposal from doctors and scientists to tax soda drinks, sweetened soda drinks. One quick question, Kelly Brownell, and that is proportion. Does portion or proportion make a big difference here?
Boy, does it ever. I mean, you mentioned when you were younger, when I was younger, the typical Coke or Pepsi, and there weren't all that many sugared beverages at
right.
that time, came in a 6.5 or 8-ounce bottle.
Yeah.
And now you see the 20-ounce bottle as the default, and that's 2.5 times the original amount of liquid and calories and sugar, of course. And when there's good research showing that when people are served more, they consume more. And as David Kessler mentioned in the outset of your show, the body doesn't seem to do very well with calories that are coming in liquid form. So it appears that even eating something like a cookie or a donut with the same number of calories may not it would have more satiating effect than sugar beverages. So they seem to be a special case.
All right. Let's open the phone. We'll go to Warren, Indiana. Good morning, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Diane.
Hi.
The debate has been framed mostly around sugar and sugar drinks. Well, in this country, we don't flavor sweetened drinks with sugar, except for a few specialty bottlers. It's all done with high fructose corn syrup. And one of your experts had mentioned how, it doesn't metabolize. Metabolizes roughly the same way. I can tell you that it doesn't. If you sit down and drink, because I don't drink this stuff regularly, drink a regular Coke, and drink 12, 16 ounces of it, I get sick. And I don't. And when I have they have kosher Coke, which is made with regular cane sugar, and it doesn't have that effect on me whatsoever. The other problem I have with it is that, so you levy this tax against ostensibly sweetened drinks. Well, your bottler and retailer are not going to have some sort of bifurcated pricing structure. I mean, I drink a lot of Diet Coke, and they're not going to be saying, Diet Coke is this much less than this.
All right, let's see what Kelly Brownell says.
There is a lot of controversy about high fructose corn syrup versus sugar, and people have experiences like your listener has. All I can do is go with the available science, and at the moment the science doesn't suggest much difference once they get into the body. The issue about how the industry would respond to a tax on sugared beverages and whether they would even that out to keep consistent prices with diet beverages is anybody's guess. We don't know what the industry would do. If they do that, then there are, of course, lots of alternatives, namely something like plain old tap water, which could save a typical family of four several thousand dollars a year by not drinking the beverages that they have to pay for.
All right.
And by the way, the industry has spent years and years and years and billions of dollars trying to convince people that these products are glamorous, sexy, athletic, you name it. And they've been good at it. They're very good at it. They use the greatest sports stars, the music celebrities, et cetera. It's time to turn that around.
Here's an email representing, I gather, several emailers. This one from Michael. He says, Justin Wilson just mentioned a study by Emory University stating how much tax you'd have to place on soda in order to see a difference in the amount of consumption. Please ask Justin Wilson which company is the largest donor to that particular university. You will see it is Coca-Cola. And Coca-Cola is certainly one of the major funders behind the ad we just heard.
I guess I'm not aware of who's funding the ad in any particular amount. I think there's a whole slew of companies that are part of that. With respect to this conspiracy theory that Coca-Cola funded this study, I don't remember what the disclosure statement was, but I think Dr. Brownell can speak more to the academic community's disclosure standards and the fact that most researchers would not allow that kind of thing to happen.
I agree with Justin on this. I don't believe that Coca-Cola was or any company was behind this particular study. But because Mr. Wilson brought this up, it is worth mentioning what the study did. Right now, about 30 states have taxes on either things like soft drinks or snack foods, but they're very small taxes, never put into place to affect consumption, but just to generate some revenue. And so what these researchers did was they looked at whether variation in the amount of the tax was related to risks for obesity in, let's say, the state. But the problem is the taxes are all pretty small. So if you have a very small tax that people don't even notice, and you multiply it by 2, 3, or 4, it's still going to be a small tax that people don't notice, and it won't affect consumption. So based on those numbers, you could say that the tax would have to be really, really high in order to affect consumption. But in fact, that's probably not true, and that's not the way taxes usually work. So the economic estimates we have are that the tax that we're suggesting, a penny per ounce on sugared beverages, would have a significant impact.
Justin.
Sure. Well, even some of the other people on Dr. Brownell's side are now starting to admit that it won't decrease consumption. I was talking with Harold Goldstein at the California Center for Public Health Advocacy, and he said, I really don't think it's going to decrease consumption, only because it's not, we have to make – let me back up. In order to actually have an impact on obesity, the tax has to be so high that it not only decreases soda consumption or sugared beverage consumption, but it decreases sugared beverage consumption to the point that there's enough calories that are not going through our body that we're actually losing weight. Now, that, of course, ignores the whole fact that people have a tendency to trade out. If you're out for drink, you know, imagine you're out to dinner with three or four friends and, well, the soda is $12 on the menu. So what do? Well, maybe you order a beer or wine. I don't see people ordering a round of tap waters, you know, and that gets to a larger point of what Dr. Brownell is talking about. Oh, well, we could just have everyone drink tap water. Well, you're right. I mean, I could make us a slimmer country and maybe we could just eat tablets that had calories in them. You know, there's this... People lose sight of the fact that we enjoy food, that it's part of our culture, and that we get joy from every once in a while having a sweet soda.
Justin, I used to get great joy from smoking a cigarette between the ages of 15 and 25. But as soon as the Surgeon General's report came out in 1964, I rethought that whole enjoyment process. And of course, since then, the taxes on a package of cigarette have gone up and up and up. And smoking in this country, with the exception of young people, smoking among adults has decreased. So there does seem to be some element of what happens when the government imposes taxes connected to human behavior for good health. Would you agree?
Soda is not tobacco. Let me say that again. There is a chasm of difference between tobacco and sugar-sweetened beverages.
How do we know when you're talking about the rate of obesity and its connection to sweetened drinks?
With tobacco, every cigarette that someone smokes, it's called the dose-response relationship. They increase their risk of cancer. And we know how many cancer deaths there are from lung cancer. When it comes to obesity, first of all, soda itself or sugar-sweetened beverages don't cause anything. Dr. Brownell, I think I will defer to you after I'm done here. It's the overconsumption of calories. It's perfectly healthy to be drinking a can of soda every once in a while. That's what I do. And I am also one of those guys that...
What does it mean to say once in a while, Justin?
Well, in my case,
yeah,
I go to the gym four nights a week and I run marathons and I usually have a soda with lunch.
Okay.
And sometimes it's diet and sometimes it's not. But let me finish this. I think it's important. The reason that sugar-sweetened beverages are not anywhere near, there's a chasm of difference between them, is that it's the overuse of them. It's not the inherent qualities of them. And it's the overuse that leads to obesity. And it's only a small proportion of the obesity equation. Like, we haven't even had the conversation about physical inactivity in this country. And that obesity is only one small portion of the total equation when it comes to the diseases that are in the constellation associated with obesity, whether it's diabetes or heart disease. You can't say that one very small factor being overused is equal to a cigarette that is immediately, every single one of them, increasing your risk.
Dr. Brownell.
Well, exactly these arguments were made by the tobacco industry to fight off taxes. And they said that it was overconsumption of cigarettes that led to disease. In fact, if one took one puff a year, you can't imagine much health damage from that sort of thing. And the people who said, well, I only smoke a cigarette every week or a day or something like that, I shouldn't be taxed on that. Well, the same argument is being used now for the case of sugared beverages. And in fact, we're not trying to put them out of business. Now, nobody ever claimed that. And a small tax might increase or decrease consumption by 10% or something like that. And if people like Mr. Wilson are only having these things occasionally, the amount of money they would have to pay in a tax would be very small, in fact. And it's not just obesity that is the health issue. It's diabetes that follows from that. And a study came out from the Harvard School of Public Health showing that there were links of sugared beverage intake with heart disease independent of the effects on weight.
Interesting. All right. Let's go now to Indianapolis. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Diane. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I'm a teacher of 37 years, and over that tenure, I've seen our health of our students decrease a little bit, and I've also seen the pop machines creep into the schools. And I know that this is very important to, for instance, Coke and Pepsi. because they fight over contracts, huge contracts with school corporations to get their product in our kids' hands. And I think that the school corporations and the legislatures, they need to step up a little bit and legislate rules on having sugar beverages in the hands of our kids when they are developing their habits. Their eating habits that they're creating at that young age.
Kelly Brownell, we've had this discussion on the program, that is the soft drink and so-called junk food machines within schools. Many within the schools say that the revenue from having these machines pays for lots of things that the schools do in a time of decreasing revenue. How do you respond to that?
There are studies looking at schools that have made a switchover from the less healthy to more healthy products in the machines, including getting rid of the sugared beverages almost entirely. And you get a small dip in income that's pretty temporary, and then it tends to rebound because kids will buy what's in the machine. So that's sort of a diversionary tactic. Now, the fact that your listener is a teacher is very interesting. If you think about the marketing of these sugared beverages to kids, you have products, let's say, like Coke and Pepsi, which are essentially indistinguishable from one another. If you do blind taste tests, not many people can tell the difference, which means that you have to sell these things on image. And they're sold with colors and logos and sports stars and things like that, as I've mentioned before. And kids are very important as an audience because their brand loyalties are established by their teenage years. So the companies have to get those people when they're young. And that's one of the things that you'd like to protect against, especially because, as with tobacco, attacks had the greatest effect on young people who were just beginning to try cigarettes. And maybe some of that same rule would apply here with sugared beverages.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Justin.
Sure. I think it's important to give a little bit of credit where credit's due. A few years ago, working with President Clinton, the soda companies agreed to voluntarily remove soda from elementary and middle schools. And in fact, I think you can only get diet soda in high school. Beyond that, the soda companies have taken this initiative upon themselves to make smaller portions available. Remember, I stand here for consumer freedom. I want the most number of options available to me. And if I'm really thirsty, I want a 20-ounce soda. And if I'm not very thirsty, they have 6-ounce sodas that are still available. And Coke is now introducing an 8-ounce soda. You know, all of these options are available. And when it comes to schools, frankly, they have made it so the options aren't necessarily available, especially for middle school and elementary schoolers.
Here's a caller in Charlotte, North Carolina, who's been holding on. Spencer, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was going to talk about Splenda being a sugar and a sugar that's twisted the wrong way so it doesn't metabolize. But what about the Internet? People sit in front of their computers for 10 hours a day, 7 days a week. Why don't we tax the Internet because it's making people fat?
Well, I think that's a little off our subject today, Spencer, but I understand the point you're making. Let's go to Cortland, New York. Pamela, quick question, please.
Thank you, Diane. My family and I drink filtered tap water and fruit juice, and I think it's kind of silly to single out sugary drinks. Why not single out high-fat fast foods and fried foods and fudge, things like that? Perhaps a better idea would be a public education program to support the benefits of physical activity, especially in schools, and that would address many other healthcare problems like the huge epidemic of cardiovascular disease, which is almost assumed to be a natural part of life when it doesn't need to be.
Dr. Brownell.
Well, your listener raises a very good point, and there's no need to think that you have to do only one. You can only address the food part of it or the physical activity part. So I'm all for education campaigns to encourage people to be more physically active. The data wouldn't suggest that it would have much of an impact on obesity, but it would definitely be good for other health-related problems. Now, the fact is, education is a sort of a wishful thinking because we've been doing this a lot for years and years. I mean, there's really very few people in the country that don't realize what's unhealthy food and what's healthy and what's junk food and what's not. Most everybody knows they should be physically active. The environment has been structured in such a way, and the food companies have been allowed to sort of reign supreme in the way we communicate these messages to people, that the environment is set up in a way that just makes it very hard for people, not impossible, but very hard for people to make the right decision.
All right. We're almost out of time. Just one quick question, Dr. Brownell. How much sugar is in a 20-ounce bottle of Coke?
It depends. Well, on Coke in particular, it's between 15 and 17 teaspoons of sugar.
Teaspoons. Wow. Kelly Brownell. He's director of Yale University's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity. Justin Wilson at the Center for Consumer Freedom. Dr. Brownell, any chance of this tax moving forward?
Oh, absolutely. I think it'll just be a matter of time until it's as routine as a tobacco tax.
All right. Thank you both so much for joining me. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org.